My name is Michael McCusker. Today, as you probably know, August 4th is Barack Obama's 50th birthday. In 15 days, it will be my 70th birthday. And that's on August 19th, which just coincidentally happens to be former President Bill Clinton's 65th birthday. He's 5 years to the day younger than I am. And George Bush is somewhat of the same age. Clinton, Bush, and Obama are the first three presidents I've been older than. Well, I'd like to read a few things about continuing national tragedies this morning. My doom and gloom mission in life. As you probably know, the debt ceiling, etc., 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 this bogus foo-for-all that was playing out in D.C. instead of taking care of the real things that are occurring to us, has so far taken all the news. And so as a prologue as to what I'm going to read, now that we're going back to the reality of life again, I'd like to read a letter from Ron Baldwin, whom many of you know, from KMUN, Bond Street Blues Band, and Flower Markets, and many, many other things. A letter he wrote to the Daily Astorian back in July 29th, a created crisis. The current deficit crisis, and that's in quotes, comes directly from the Chicago School of Business crises, capitalism playbook. Generate a fake emergency crisis that can be sold to the greedies while the tweeting, Facebooking public looks the other way. Swoop in at a lightning speed to strangle the markets and sell off the public lands and other assets, unfair gas, oil, and public lands giveaways, while strangling working people with all the taxes. Stifle democracy and the will of the majority, supermajorities, by the press, politicians and judges, Supreme Court decision, corporations are people, and put the Treasury in control of the international banking interests while gutting public and private pensions and health programs. The new Republicans will not be happy until working people are brought to their knees begging for alms. They gained the upper hand in Congress due to the chicken voting for the axe phenomenon. Now it's time for them to pounce. And that was Ron Baldwin. And I noticed in the Daily Astorian today a letter from my old friend, I beg your pardon, the Oregonian this morning, my old friend Ansel Nance, one of Oregon's great photographers. Now that the sideshow, the deficit, is over, it is time for both parties to get down to creating jobs for the 14 million unemployed who are no longer able to contribute anything to the economy. We have been distracted by the talk about the deficit, but not one person in Congress has put forward a jobs bill. If the Tea Party people can create jobs without spending money, now is the time for them to step forward. If they can't, then it is time for them to be quiet and let some government spending create jobs the way it always has in past depressions. Free enterprise can either put up or get out of the way. And that was Ansel Nance from Portland. And by the way, Ron Baldwin lives in Chinook, Washington. Well, these serve as prologue. I would now like to get to the main show with an article by Joseph E. Stiglitz that he wrote for Vanity Fair in 2011, in May 2011. Of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%. Americans have been watching protests against oppressive regimes that concentrate massive wealth in the hands of an elite few. Yet in our own democracy, 1% of the people take nearly a quarter of the nation's income, and inequality, even the wealthy, will come to regret. It is no use pretending that what has obviously happened has not in fact happened. The upper 1% of Americans are now taking in nearly a quarter of the nation's income every year. In terms of wealth rather than income, the top 1% control 40%. Their lot in life has improved considerably. 25 years ago, the corresponding figures were 12% and 33%. One response might be to celebrate the ingenuity and drive that brought good fortune to these people and to contend that a rising tide lifts all boats. That response would be misguided. While the top 1% have seen their incomes rise 18% over the past decade, those in the middle have actually seen their incomes fall. For men with only high school degrees, the decline has been precipitous, 12% in the last quarter century alone. All the growth in recent decades and more has gone to those at the top. In terms of income equality, America lags behind any country in the old, ossified Europe that President George W. Bush used to deride. Among our closest counterparts are Russia with its oligarchs and Iran. While many of the old centers of inequality in Latin America, such as Brazil, have been striving in recent years, rather successfully, to improve the plight of the poor and reduce gaps in income, America has allowed inequality to grow. Economists long ago tried to justify the vast inequalities that seemed so troubling in the mid-19th century, inequalities that are but a pale shadow of what we are seeing in America today. The justification they came up with was called marginal productive theory. In a nutshell, this theory associated higher incomes with higher productivity and a greater contribution to society. It is a theory that has always been cherished by the rich. Evidence for its validity, however, remains thin. The corporate executives who helped bring on the recession of the past 3 years, whose contribution to our society and to their own companies has been massively negative, went on to receive large bonuses. In some cases, companies were so embarrassed about calling such rewards performance bonuses, and that's a quote, that they felt compelled to change the name to retention bonuses, also a quote, even if the only thing being retained was bad performance. Those who have contributed great positive innovations to our society, from the pioneers of genetic understanding to the pioneers of the information age, have received a pittance compared with those responsible for the financial innovations that brought our global economy to the brink of ruin. Some people look at income inequality and shrug their shoulders. So what if this person gains and that person loses? What matters, they argue, is not how the pie is divided, but the size of the pie. That argument is fundamentally wrong. An economy in which most citizens are doing worse year after year, an economy like America's, is not likely to do well over the long haul. There are several reasons for this. First, growing inequality is the flip side of something else, shrinking opportunity. Whenever we diminish equality of opportunity, it means that we are not using some of our most valuable assets, our people, in the most productive way possible. Second, many of the distortions that lead to inequality, such as those associated with monopoly power and preferential tax treatment for special interests, undermine the efficiency of the economy. This new inequality goes on to create new distortions, undermining efficiency even further. To give just one example, far too many of our most talented young people, seeing the astronomical rewards, have gone on into finance rather than into fields that would lead to a more productive and healthy economy. Third, and perhaps most important, a modern economy requires collective action. It needs government to invest in infrastructure, education, and technology. The United States and the world have benefited greatly from government-sponsored research that led to the Internet, to advances in public health, and so on. But America has long suffered from an underinvestment in infrastructure. Look at the condition of our highways and bridges, our railroads and airports. in basic research and in education at all levels. Further cutbacks in these areas lie ahead. None of this should come as a surprise. It is simply what happens when a society's wealth distribution becomes lopsided. The more divided a society becomes in terms of wealth, the more reluctant the wealthy become to spend money on common needs. The rich don't need to rely on government for parks or education or medical care or personal security. They can buy all these things for themselves. In the process, they become more distant from ordinary people, losing whatever empathy they may once have had. They also worry about strong government, one that can use its powers to adjust the balance, take some of their wealth, and invest it for the common good. The top 1% may complain about the kind of government we have in America, but in truth, they like it just fine. Too gridlocked to redistribute, too divided to do anything but lower taxes. Economists are not sure how to fully explain the growing inequality in America. The ordinary dynamics of supply and demand have certainly played a role. Labor-saving technologies have reduced the demand for many good middle-class blue-collar jobs. Globalization has created a worldwide marketplace, pitting expensive, unskilled workers in America against cheap, unskilled workers overseas. Social changes have also played a role. For instance, the decline of unions, which once represented a third of American workers and now represents about 12%. But one part of the reason we have so much inequality is the top 1% want it that way. The most obvious example involves tax policy. Lowering tax rates on capital gains, which is how the rich receive a large portion of their income, has given the wealthiest Americans close to a free ride. Monopolies and near monopolies have always been a source of economic power, from John D. Rockefeller at the beginning of the last century to Bill Gates at the end. Lax enforcement of antitrust laws, especially during Republican administrations, has been a godsend to the top 1%. Much of today's inequality is due to manipulation of the financial system, enabled by changes in the rules that have been bought and paid for by the financial industry itself, one of its best investments ever. The government lent money to financial institutions at close to 0% interest and provided generous bailouts on favorable terms when all else failed. Regulators turned a blind eye to a lack of transparency and to conflicts of interest. When you look at the sheer volume of wealth controlled by the top 1% in this country, it is tempting to see our growing inequality as a quintessentially American achievement. We started way behind the pack, but now we're doing inequality on a world-class level. And it looks as if we'll be building on this achievement for years to come, because what made it possible is self-reinforcing. Wealth begets power, which begets more wealth. During the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s, a scandal whose dimensions, by today's standards, seem almost quaint, the banker Charles Keating was asked by a congressional committee whether the $1.5 million he had spread among a few key elected officials could actually buy influence. "I certainly hope so," he replied. The Supreme Court, in its recent Citizens United case, has enshrined the right of corporations to buy government by removing limitations on campaign spending. The personal and political are today in perfect alignment. Virtually all U.S. senators and most of the representatives in the House are members of the top 1% when they arrive, are kept in office by money from the top 1%, and know that if they serve the top 1% well, they will be rewarded by the top 1% when they leave office. By and large, the key executive branch policymakers on trade and economic policy also come from the top 1%. When pharmaceutical companies receive a $1 trillion gift through legislation prohibiting the government, the largest buyer of drugs, from bargaining over price, it should not come as cause for wonder. It should not make jaws drop that a tax bill cannot emerge from Congress unless big tax cuts are put in place for the wealthy. Given the power of the top 1%, this is the way you would expect the system to work. America's inequality distorts our society in every conceivable way. There is, for one thing, a well-documented lifestyle effect. People outside the top 1% increasingly live beyond their means. Trickle-down economics may be a chimera, but trickle-down behaviorism is very real. Inequality massively distorts our foreign policy. The top 1% rarely serve in the military. The reality is that the all-volunteer, and that's a quote, army does not pay enough to attract their sons and daughters, and patriotism goes only so far. Plus, the wealthiest class feels no pinch from higher taxes when the nation goes to war. Borrowed money will pay for all that. Foreign policy, by definition, is about the balancing of national interests and national resources. With the top 1% in charge and paying no price, the notion of balance and restraint goes out the window. There is no limit to the adventures we can undertake. Corporations and contractors stand only to gain. The rules of economic globalization are likewise designed to benefit the rich. They encourage competition among countries for business, which drives down taxes on corporations, weakens health and environmental protections, and undermines what used to be viewed as the core labor rights, which include the right to collective bargaining. Imagine what the world might look like if the rules were designed instead to encourage competition among countries for workers. Governments would compete in providing economic security, low taxes on ordinary wage earners, good education, and a clean environment, things workers care about. But the top 1% don't need to care. Or, more accurately, they think they don't. Of all the costs imposed on our society by the top 1%, perhaps the greatest is this: the erosion of our sense of identity, in which fair play, equality of opportunity, and a sense of community are so important. America has long prided itself on being a fair society, where everyone has an equal chance of getting ahead, but the statistics suggest otherwise. The chances of a poor citizen, or even a middle-class citizen, making it to the top in America are smaller than in many countries of Europe. The cards are stacked against them. It is this sense of an unjust system without opportunity that has given rise to the conflagrations in the Middle East. Rising food prices and growing and persistent youth unemployment simply served as kindling. With youth unemployment in America at around 20%, and in some locations, and among socio-demographic groups at twice that, with one out of six Americans desiring a full-time job not able to get one, with one out of seven Americans on food stamps, and about the same number suffering from food insecurity, and that's a quote, given all this, there is ample evidence that something has blocked the vaunted trickling down, and that's also in quotes, from the top 1% to everyone else. All of this is having the predictable effect of creating alienation. Voter turnout among those in their 20s in the last election stood at 21%, comparable to the unemployment rate. In recent weeks, we have watched people taking to the streets by the millions to protest political, economic, and social conditions in the oppressive societies they inhabit. Governments have been toppled in Egypt and Tunisia. Protests have erupted in Libya, Yemen, and Bahrain. The ruling families elsewhere in the region look on nervously from their air-conditioned penthouses. Will they be next? They are right to worry. These are societies where a minuscule fraction of the population, less than 1%, controls the lion's share of the wealth, where wealth is a main determinant of power, where entrenched corruption of one sort or another is a way of life, and where the wealthiest often stand actively in the way of policies that would improve life for people in general. As we gaze out at the popular fervor in the streets, one question to ask ourselves is this: when will it come to America? In important ways, our own country has become like one of those distant, troubled places. Alexis de Tocqueville once described what he saw as a chief part of the peculiar genius of American society, something he called self-interest properly understood. The last two words were the key. Everyone possesses self-interest in a narrow sense. I want what's good for me right now. Self-interest, properly understood, is different. It means appreciating that paying attention to everyone else's self-interest, in other words, the common welfare, is in fact a precondition for one's own ultimate well-being. De Tocqueville was not suggesting that there was anything noble or idealistic about this outlook. In fact, he was suggesting the opposite. It was a mark of American pragmatism. These canny Americans understood a basic fact. Looking out for the other guy isn't just good for the soul, it's good for business. The top 1% have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, and the best lifestyles. But there is one thing that money doesn't seem to have bought: an understanding that their fate is bound up with how the other 99% live. throughout history, this is something that the top 1% eventually do learn. Too late. And that was Of the 1%, By the 1%, For the 1%, by Joseph E. Stiglitz. And it appeared in the May 2011 Vanity Fair. And to continue in the same vein, 10 things you can do to starve the Wall Street beast and grab yourself a piece of the pie, by Pam Martins of Counterpunch. Dialogue on the economic crisis has focused on symptoms: bailouts, corruption on Wall Street, collapse in housing prices, intractable unemployment, Federal Reserve monetary policy. Most people have been socialized to silence on the topic of the disease itself, debilitating wealth concentration. We hear little on the overwhelming argument that wealth concentration is the root cause of the lingering crisis, because within milliseconds of the words escaping into the public arena, screams of socialist, socialist proliferate. An army of right-wing talk radio buffoons fill the airwaves with dire warnings of the growing communist threat of wealth redistribution. Rick Santelli spazzes out on CNBC, and the Tea Partiers figuratively, or literally, stomp on us. The people who scream the loudest aren't the super-rich who control the wealthy. They're part of the labyrinthine network of hired hands who function as high-pitched bodyguards for the wealth hoarders. The actual super-rich are the folks who appear on the Forbes list of the wealthiest Americans, people like Charles and David Koch, each worth $21.5 billion, who create multi-layers of front groups, like Americans for Prosperity, to make it not only socially acceptable to hoard wealth, but social nirvana. The Koches hold secret confabs with their wealthy friends once a year, fingering their worry beads and plotting to keep the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest, lest they become number 6 on the Forbes list of billionaires instead of number 5. This, while 43 million of their fellow Americans live beneath the poverty level, including one in every 5 children. David Barber, associate professor of American history at the University of Tennessee, is not afraid of the cacophony from the wealth hoarders' cabal, writing bluntly about the dangers of wealth concentration. In response to an email query last November, Dr. Barber said, "American society's fantastically skewed distribution of wealth stands as one of the main structural fault lines underpinning the crash. America's richest 1% of the population own over 40% of America's wealth, exclusive of home ownership. In this, the most opulent society history has ever known. On the other hand, the bottom 60% of Americans own approximately 1% of all of America's wealth. Maintaining the Bush tax cuts for the rich only perpetuates a part of the contradiction which brought on the present phase of the world economic crisis." Dr. Barber's statistics come from a study conducted by Edward N. Wolfe for the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College in March 2010. Other findings from that study include the following: the richest 1% received over one-third of the total gain in marketable wealth over the period from 1938 to 2007. The next 4% also received about a third of the total gain, and the next 15% about a fifth, so that the top quintile collectively accounted for 89% of the total growth in wealth, while the bottom 80% accounted for 11%. In 2007, the top 1% of households owned 38% of all stocks. The top 5% owned 69%. The top 10% held 81%. Debt was the most evenly distributed component of household wealth, with the bottom 90% of households responsible for 73% of total indebtedness. Wealth concentration in too few hands, while the general populace is saddled with too much debt to buy the goods and services produced by the corporations, in whom the wealthiest hold 81% of the stock, is a replay of the conditions leading to the crash of 1929 and the ensuing Great Depression. The Social Security system was born out of that debacle. This time around, the wealthiest hope to use the funds from the bottom 90% flowing into the Social Security Trust to prop up stock prices for the benefit of the top 10%. Any action today which postpones the inevitable process of more equitable wealth distribution, such as privatizing Social Security or retaining the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest, will simply hasten the onset of more economic pain, which will broaden out to devour the wealth of the upper quintiles through deflation. According to March 31, 2009, data from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, four Wall Street behemoths control 35% of all the insured bank deposits in the U.S. and 46% of the assets, although the quality of those assets is very much a subject of debate. Those firms are Bank of America Corporation, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, Wells Fargo & Company, and Citigroup Incorporated. That leaves the other 8,242 FDIC-insured banking institutions to share the balance. The total domestic deposits were $7.5 trillion, with total assets of $13.5 trillion as of March 2009. That is far too much wealth concentration in too few hands, as we've sadly learned from having to bail out those four institutions. Seek your accountant and financial advisor's advice about converting your 30-year mortgage to a 15-year to move wealth from the bank's shareholders' pockets to yours. Rates have never been more favorable for such a move. Typically, over for the life of the loan, you will save tens of thousands of dollars of interest. You can look at the savings for your specific situation by clicking on the mortgage calculator at www.bankrate.com. I'm not endorsing any of the bank loans offered at this site, since I haven't done any research in that area. I'm just suggesting the use of the mortgage calculator. And that is actually the first, shorten your home mortgage. Former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis summed it up. We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. The Wall Street beast is thriving on interest on our debt and using it to hire lobbyists and fund politicians who will work for their interests, not ours. And number two, think local. Consider moving money as it becomes liquid out of the big Wall Street banks that have an iron grip on your Congress and moving it into FDIC-insured certificates of deposit at your community bank, being careful not to exceed the insurance limits. A good rule of thumb is to ladder maturities to coincide with when you will need the money. Again, you should consult with your accountant and/or financial advisor. This will also help provide loan funds to local businesses and residential housing in your area. 3. Start a business. Don't worry about the possible arrival of the pink slip. Be proactive. Start a business on the side. Do well by doing good. What product or service can you provide that a struggling consumer wants and can afford? Ideas might include debt counseling, low-cost childcare, foreclosure counseling, a pick-your-own-fruit and vegetable business if you own farmland, consignment shop, home staging services to help with quicker resales. 4. Invest wisely. Get smart with your 401k. Investing in the S&P 500 is simply feeding the beast. The beast that's using your cheap capital to hire lobbyists, create PACs, and separate you from representative government. Some 401k plans allow you to roll over 50% or to move your own IRA after reaching a certain age. Call your benefits office and find out what your options are. Speak to your accountant and/or financial advisor before making any move. You may also want to consider opening an IRA at a community bank and buying insured CDs as an alternative to putting more funds in the 401k. 5. Check out credit union membership. Do you have a family member that belongs to a credit union? Chances are they can get you an account there. If you need to use a credit card, try to get one through the credit union at a reasonable rate and then cut up any high-rate card. It's an outrage that some of the banks that required a citizen bailout are getting their money from the Federal Reserve at almost no cost while charging struggling citizens 20% interest. Number 6. Don't use credit cards from corporations that abuse you. All of the following have one thing in common. Home Depot, ExxonMobil, Shell, Macy's, Sears, Zales, they all extend credit to their customers on a Citigroup credit card. 40 million customers are helping to prop up Citigroup and its anti-consumer, anti-citizen practices by using these cards. Citigroup makes its workers sign away their rights to go to court and has serially abused investors through corrupt practices. 7. Brand attacks. Chances are high that your local store owners don't have a PAC and lobbyist on K Street working against your interests. Reward them with your business and starve the S&P 500 firms until they get the message. If you want me to honor your brand, honor my right to representative government. 8. Return the courts to workers. Many of the largest corporations force workers to sign away their rights to the nation's courts as a condition of unemployment. It is called mandatory arbitration, and it's an unfair process that is rigged to favor the corporation. If you interview for a new job, ask if the company has such a policy and walk away if they do. 9. Complain. Don't let shady practices go undetected. Write a detailed report and file it with the appropriate body. Local district attorney, state attorney general's office, consumer protection groups, and write a letter to the editor to the local paper. This helps good businesses prosper and starves dirty businesses of customers. 10. Just say no to frontal nudity, photographs, skin radiation, genitalia, groping, all just aboard a plane. Don't fly. You'll be standing up for civil rights and starving Wall Street. Body scanner companies trade on Wall Street, and the banksters are hoping domestic surveillance is their new cash cow. And that was 10 Things You Can Do to Starve the Wall Street Beast and Grab Yourself a Piece of the Pie by Pam Martins, who worked on Wall Street for 21 years. She has no security position, long or short, in any company mentioned in this article. And she writes on public interest issues from New Hampshire. And this has been Michael McCusker. And I will probably be back next Thursday if the sky doesn't fall or a truck run me down or I fall into the river.